Hey, Discern listeners, today's episode and the other two episodes this week, all three episodes this week, are going to be audio versions of a bunch of videos that I posted on YouTube recently. I don't normally do this, but after recording the videos, I thought it'd be good to share with the audio podcast audience because I ended up talking a lot about clinical things. The videos are of me reacting to a therapy session with Andrew Tate. If you don't know who he is, consider yourself lucky. He's probably the most well-known misogynist in the world, or at least in the English-speaking world. He has millions and millions of followers around the world, mainly boys and young men. He has allegedly been a sex trafficker and he's allegedly committed other kinds of crimes that he's currently dealing with in the justice system in Europe. And he, Andrew Tate, posted a video of him in a therapy session. The video is over 2 hours long. I think it's almost 2.5 hours. And a bunch of people sent me the video wanting me to comment on the video, react to the video. And when I first sat down to watch this so-called therapy session, I figured it was just going to be yet another video of him being misogynistic and him selling his bullshit to young, susceptible minds. But I soon realized that the therapy session was a good representation of therapy, and really not only a good representation of what therapy should look like, but also a good representation of how to work with clients who specifically suffer from narcissistic personality disorder. So I condensed the 8 videos I published on YouTube down to 3 audio episodes, which I will be posting starting today and the other 2 later this week. And let me know what you think, and here we go. Hey, Discern listeners, a lot of you have been asking me to react to this video on YouTube in which Andrew Tate goes to therapy. It is on the YouTube channel called Cobra Conquer, and I want to say as some caveats, normally I don't do this, but I've actually watched this entire video already. It's over 2 hours long, and I just want to provide some caveats before I go into it. One is that I didn't know who the therapist was. Halfway through the video, he reveals himself to be potentially more of a misogynist than Andrew Tate is. But I didn't know that, and I was giving David, the therapist, the benefit of the doubt. So I'm worried that as I'm watching and I'm giving David the benefit of the doubt, that people will be angry at me for not attacking David because you or other people will know that David, the therapist, is a massive misogynist. I didn't know. I didn't even know who he was. Eventually, I kind of figure out who he was later as I'm watching, but I just want to say that. I also want to say that even though he is seemingly a massive misogynist and has probably a lot of problematic views that may or may not impact his work with his clients, I don't know. Even though that's true, I can still identify things in David's approach that are laudable, that are positive, that are techniques or approaches that I can get behind. The other thing I want to say up front is that I did not think that this session would actually get anywhere because of what I know about Andrew Tate. I thought this would just be an opportunity for Andrew Tate to brag about himself, and he does spend a majority of the session doing that, but there are moments where some movement seemingly is happening, and I am saying that because it takes a while for it to get there, so you might have to watch a few of my reaction videos before we get there, but eventually it ends at the very end of the 2-hour 12-minute session of what I would observe to be a very powerful moment and a good example of what a version of good therapy can look like. So it really does pay off. I'm able to say and react to things in reaction to this video that I've never been able to talk about on this YouTube channel before because I've never been provoked to. I've never been given an example because therapy is very complicated and there's a lot of things that you can't really explain, but if we see an example and then I comment on it, you can. So I don't know. I found this to be a very interesting watch. So if you're interested, you can stick through my yammering. So we're going to go to me in the past, because when I first started watching this video, I hadn't seen anything. So just keep that in mind. Let's get to it.
In reality, through the conviction of your thoughts, your beliefs, and the words that you use.
Why else would you adopt any kind of mindset unless it's designed specifically to make you competitive and make you win? You install the software in your mind, right? So if I'm gonna install software
in
my mind.
Did you install it?
Well, I've tried very hard to create it.
Right, because wasn't it installed by your upbringing? Wasn't it installed by your mother and your father?
The first thing I should say is that, is this an actual therapy session as it is advertised? Because in a typical therapy session, There is a conversation about what the client wants from therapy. I think there's a belief among the lay public that therapy is something that you just sort of sit down and the therapist does something to the client. But that is not good therapy. Good therapy is when a client sits down and presents something. I would like to work on this. I have a problem with this. I am struggling with this. And then the therapist talks with the client about how they're going to help them with that, what sort of things are going to do to reach that goal. And without that, then it's just a conversation. And I don't even know who this individual is. From context, it seems like maybe this individual is an actual clinician, but I don't know.
Ready to break the internet, friend?
How are we going to break the internet? You said you wanted this to be impactful. What would that look like to you?
That's a really good question. I think a lot of people are...
I just looked up the guy's name, David Sutcliffe. He's an actor, a Canadian actor, but with that beard, I didn't recognize him. So why did David Sutcliffe quit acting? Oh, he quit acting to become a therapist. Okay. That's, you don't usually see that happen every day.
Conversation.
Does it make you nervous that there may be things that you don't know about yourself that I'm going to try to reveal to you?
I know everything about myself, my
friend. You know everything about yourself.
I believe that I have an intimate grasp of all the things about myself which matter, which allow...
No, it's possible. I don't know Andrew Tate well enough, obviously, to know about that claim that he knows himself. It's hard to know what that means exactly, but I will say that that is potentially lacking in self-awareness to say. I will say from experience, when I hear that from people, particularly when they say it in that way, I usually will conclude later that they, in fact, did not know themselves very well. And we just have to think about why people say certain things. It's very helpful as a therapist to think about, you know, what people are saying between the lines, the meta content, in that it's probable, given what I know about Andrew Tate, that when he says, I know everything there is about me, he's not just making a statement verbatim about that information. He is saying, back off. He's saying, there's nothing you're going to get from me, and anything you're going to try to dig at will be fruitless because I don't have a traumatic side. I don't have a weak side. I don't have some deep, dark secret that I'm trying to hide or something. And I'm in control. That's probably another meta content bit of information he's trying to get across. Like if I were to say, there is no possible way that I know everything about my personality. That's just a ridiculous comment or statement. I've done a lot of work, but I probably have a lot more to learn, and I will probably never learn. And I have a bias. I have a point of view. So even if I did quote unquote learn, I will filter it through the way that I see the world, for better or for worse. And I am not in control completely of my psychology, of my behavior, of my personality, of my defenses, of my biases. I will overreact. I will get upset when I shouldn't be. I will be hurt when I shouldn't be. I will be overly hurt when I shouldn't be. I will stuff my emotions. I will judge others. These are things that aren't good that I have a hard time dealing with when I look at them. You know, that's normal. That's human. But by saying that, it to some will come across like I'm not in full control over my faculties, that I'm weak. I think he tries to come across like he's in full control so that he can give a vibe that people should follow him because he has it all figured out. Another thing to think about, I guess more down to earth with clients when I hear this sort of thing, it usually indicates that they absolutely know that there are dark corners to their personality, but they're so ashamed of it that they cannot bear to have others know of those corners' existence. And they might even be shutting themselves off to that information because of how ashamed they are. So that would be my initial hypothesis if I had a client in the first session say such a thing.
Allow me to compete.
Right.
So there may be things I don't know, but I'm not sure if I particularly need them. So I'm not that interested.
Right. What's useful is more important than what's true.
Absolutely.
Right. And you've developed a framework of thinking about yourself and thinking about reality that's been incredibly effective for you.
Completely. Right. What's useful is more, you nailed it. What's useful is more important than what's true. This is an old argument of mine, but I think we discussed it in the last podcast, yeah. And I'll say it again. when I say I don't believe in depression, nobody can convince me to believe in depression. That's not a matter of discussing whether depression's real or not. That's a matter of me accepting that my mental model for going through life is more effective if I don't believe I can become a depressed person. Yeah.
From my understanding and my memory, he was detained in Europe by the authorities due to allegations of something related to sex trafficking. Women were coming forward saying that he had coerced them, forced them into sex work, and had abused them as well. I think there were a number of different alleged victims. Anyway, I think he's talking a little bit about that. I think what he's saying, which is fine, is that if I allow myself to go down a certain road of what he calls depression, then that will be bad for me. So I just have to not believe in depression. I have to keep going. I have to, you know, keep myself motivated. I have to not get down. I have to not go down those roads of thinking, because it'll be bad for me. It'll be bad for my business. And that's the way I live my life. That's how I get myself through the day. I think what he's kind of referring to indirectly is he's been through some bad times lately for himself. Now, I think a lot of people, the majority of people would say, well, you know, you mess with the bull, you get the horns. You know, fuck around and find out, I guess, is another phrase that people would say, meaning that you commit crimes and you go to prison, right? You know, the statement that he says of, I don't believe in depression, if you just heard that, you would say, well, that's stupid, because it's a construct that we have been using in the field of psychology and psychiatry for decades, if not over a century. And it's a well-researched phenomenon among humans. Now, you know, it's a squishy concept. It's not like a diagnosis like cancer or something where you can actually open up the body and find the cancer cells and look at the cancer cells under a microscope and identify them and differentiate those cancer cells from other cells in the body. There's nothing like that in psychiatry and psychology. But it is a very distinct syndrome, condition, disorder that is quite noticeable and definable.
I don't believe in depression, so I can't be depressed. So that allows me to be more effective. It's not a matter of sitting there going, well, maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. I don't believe in it.
So- yeah. And then the way he says it is ridiculous, that somehow people who are depressed are allowing themselves to be depressed. And if they just chose to not be depressed, then they wouldn't. That's ridiculous. And it's his whole persona. That's what he's trying to sell. And that's what his misogynistic males are looking for. Young, impressionable males who are adrift in our society and don't know where to land, find him and find him to be an exaggeration of what they have absorbed. The reason why he's popular is because as our society in the West, you know, in the United States, Canada, and in other parts of the world, are shifting away from toxic masculine ideas and ideologies, you all have a transition zone, if you will, where you have a lot of boys and men who have already been indoctrinated into the masculine ideals, for better or for worse. You know, there are good things about masculinity, for sure, that I adhere to. And there are negative things, what they call toxic things about masculinity, that we're trying to evaluate and discard. But not everyone has a mentor or a role model or a place to talk about that. So you have all these men and boys who have been fully indoctrinated into toxic masculine ideas. And then all of a sudden, overnight, seemingly, they're being attacked and told that, and they're also misunderstanding it to mean that all of masculinity is wrong, which is not the case. It's just a section, a percentage, probably a small percentage. I mean, the entire discourse around masculinity is important to evaluate, but for me, there's only certain things that are discardable and should be discarded and aren't harmful. They're just harmful notions that we are given. Like, men can't have emotions. That's toxic masculine. That's a toxic masculine idea, which is inhuman and harmful to men and everyone around them. So for these boys and men, they've already been brainwashed and conditioned, and they, you know, they've already started orienting their lives in that direction. Then all of a sudden they're told that they're horrible and they have nowhere to look. So Andrew Tate and other people like him emerge because these men and boys need someone to save them. And the things that he says are exaggerations of toxic masculine ideals, such as I'm in total control of myself and I just have to use my mind and my the strength of my brain, the strength of my willpower is so strong that I can overcome any mental issue, even depression, which is a very destructive thing to say to people and illogical, unscientific, and ridiculous. Now, if he wants to say, there are times when I find myself going down a certain pattern of behavior and thinking that I have found leads to bad things for me that I call depression, I doubt he actually suffered from action, because if he actually had depression, he wouldn't be talking this way. But I don't know, who knows? And, you know, if he himself said, look, if I start going down a certain road, and, you know, people, I've treated people with major depression, and some people will have that solution, not everyone. They will have a solution of, I just have, like Lady Gaga talked about this in an interview, I think with Oprah. She said that she suffers from depression or some sort of mood issue. What she said was that in the morning, she just gets up. She wants to just stay in bed. She wants to just avoid and shut down. But she knows that if she does that, it'll just cascade. So she just takes one step. Okay, get up, take a shower. Okay, eat something. Walk the dog. You know, it can be hard work. For non-depressed people, it doesn't feel as arduous, but for depressed people, it can feel very arduous. And so some people will cope with that by saying, I'm not going to allow myself to become depressed. I'm going to not give in to the depression. It doesn't take away the depression, but it is a component in some individuals with mood disorders in their solution to the problem. So if he said something like that, that would be great. But what he's saying is essentially everyone who is depressed does not have my strength of mind. Which is quite a brag.
Well, I can't catch it.
You shape your own reality through the conviction of your thoughts, your beliefs, and the words that you use.
Why else would you adopt any kind of mindset unless it's designed specifically to make you competitive and make you win? You install the software in your mind, right? So if I'm going to install software in my mind.
So everything's about competition and winning, which is also a part of the toxic masculine ideology. Now, I like to compete and I like to win as well. If I'm playing cards or when I was a kid when I played sports or if I'm trying to get views on YouTube, for example, you know, it's a bit of a, I wouldn't say competition, but, you know, I'm trying to succeed. So that there's nothing wrong with that, right? But the way that he talks about it, that it's the sole reason for living is to compete, meaning I will beat others. You know, it's one thing to succeed. It's another thing to compete. Compete means you're competing against. You are winning over. Other people are losing. You're winning and everyone else is losing.
Well, I've tried very hard to create it.
Right. Because wasn't it installed by your upbringing? Wasn't it installed by your mother and your father in some way?
Good question.
Before you were conscious, while you were just a developing child, like something got programmed into your psyche that has to have an impact on you.
I will say that, I'm looking up his name again, David Sutcliffe, I think was it? Yeah. I will say that, you know, we don't know what's going on in his mind. He might even come across like he likes Andrew Tate, but it's also, and maybe he does, meaning that he believes in Andrew Tate's message. Who knows? But given what I've seen so far, it is also possible that David Sutcliffe, if you were to talk with him behind the scenes, like if you were a friend of his, he might say something like, oh yeah, Andrew Tate is an awful, awful person. But when I'm being a therapist or I'm in that role, then I have a much different mindset and vibe. Because for me, as a therapist, that happens not so often anymore because I, you know, in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, the sort of clients that I've had in my practice, I haven't really ran into this. But before that, there were many instances where I would be working with a client and had, you know, if I were free to evaluate them as like a friend or someone I would want to hang out with or someone I wouldn't mind dating one of my family members or something, then I would have a lot of judgmental or critical or cautionary things to say about this individual. But for us therapists, it's important for us to build rapport and for us to have a connection, for them to trust us and be safe with it. If we're going, the people that are the most abrasive to therapists are typically very abrasive to everyone around them. And the people who are very abrasive to everyone around them, including therapists, need the most therapy. And if they're going to stay in therapy, then they have to feel safe with us. They have to kind of like us. They have to feel like we're on their side. So when I talk with individuals who otherwise I might try to distance myself from, I lean in and I enter their world.
And those things can't necessarily be known because you were at such a young age.
Absolutely. We're all programmed to some degree. I agree with you on this so far. I don't think anybody can escape programming, whether it's society, whether it's a television show, whether it's the people around you, peer pressure, whether it's a religion. We're all programmed to some degree. That's absolutely not really true. What I have done, and what I think most people do not do, is heavily analyze why I hold the beliefs I hold, mm-hmm. why they help me. If I don't hold the belief personally, or if I didn't learn it from personal experience, I know where it came from, who tried to teach me that, whether their intentions for me were good or bad.
So he's just doubling down on that idea that he is in full control and he's smarter or better or has better willpower or a system or something. But like I was saying earlier, it's possible, but not likely. It's more likely that this is him either wanting to sell his product. You know, he comes across to me like a salesperson constantly. I think he's in a constant state of selling something. And he does sell a lot of things, classes and other kinds of things, right? So I think he is savvy in that way. And also, it's possible that he's trying to convince himself and everyone around him that he lacks any weakness or inferiority as he sees it because he believes himself to be extremely inferior and extremely flawed. And he's in this constant defensive treadmill running, trying to get forward in life, even though he's getting nowhere, trying to run away from that notion that he developed when he was younger for some reason.
I've tried very hard to have my mindset rigidly analyzed and make sure that it's put together in a way which benefits me completely and absolutely. And I do not believe in things that take away power from me. Right. I refuse to do that. I would rather say that they are not real. And people will sit here and argue to the end of time that they are real, but they're not real in my world, and I live inside of my mind. So even if you throw me in a Romanian dungeon, the idea that I become a depressed person is not a framework that my mind works within, so I can't become depressed. I can feel a little bit sad. Sure, I can feel depressed. But I can't be depressed.
I will say that as a therapist, I have had clients like him who, when I'm doing it right, eventually they will assume that I am mostly on board with their way of thinking because I haven't refuted it. I haven't argued against it. I haven't agreed with it overtly, but I have investigated and I've reflected and I've tried to pick out things that I can complement, if you will. When that starts to happen, I know that I'm establishing rapport with a client. I will tell myself that, okay, you know, eventually I'm going to start to test the waters regarding how sensitive they are to criticism or how intolerant they are to exploring the possibility that they don't have it all figured out. Because For people who present this way, you know, again, behind the closed doors, he might not be anything like this. I don't know. But people who present like this in therapy have typically they have a very, very huge sensitivity to criticism and any implications that they don't have it all figured out because that's their foundation of safety. The only way that they feel safe in the world is if everyone else understands and they themselves have deluded themselves. You know, they've deluded everyone and themselves that they have it all figured out. If they can do that and there's a constant need for supply around that, then they can kind of relax. They're not fully ever relaxed because of their traumas that are always chasing them, but they can kind of relax. Any implication, meaning that if someone close to them, a therapist, were to think, you know, there's a question mark there. I don't know if you have it all figured out. That opens this, you know, if the door is ajar, yeah, it's sort of like in those comedy movies where they shove all the clutter in the house into a closet and then someone comes along and opens the door ajar and all the stuff just comes pouring out. That's how it feels to them. If someone opens the door ajar and says, I don't know if you have it all figured out, they're terrified and convinced that all of their flaws and inferiority aspects will just come flooding in. And sometimes they do, and they will decompensate, and they will suffer greatly. But anyway, so he's talking about going to prison, and he said he did get sad sometimes. And so that's a little bit in the direction of what some might call weakness. It's not weak to be sad. It's human to be sad. It's like saying it's weak to be thirsty or something. It's just an evolved feeling that we have. And it's an indication of, you know, if you're in prison, you might feel unfairly treated or might feel extremely limited in your freedom and uncertain about the future, pessimistic about the future. And then you get sad.
Which is going to allow me to be a fearsome competitor in all realms of human endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Have there been some of your beliefs or convictions that have been challenged through the experiences that you've had, particularly in the last, well, recently?
Well, people challenge me often. And what a lot of people don't understand is that.
Yeah, so David Sutcliffe was asking, I believe, what he was asking was, have any of your beliefs that you had prior to all the things that have happened to you lately, has reality challenged those such that you've changed your beliefs, or have you challenged your own beliefs at all? That's what David is asking, I think. That's a, you know, kind of a good question to ask given where Andrew Tate was headed. And then Andrew Tate answers it in the way that he did, which is, well, yeah, people are trying to challenge my beliefs, and this is how that they're all wrong. Isn't that interesting that David asked a question about just Andrew Tate? Like, forget everyone else. Just think about yourself. When have you, and maybe David will follow it up with that, but has there ever been a time when you changed your belief based on what was happening to you? And that's kind of like the paradox where people will say, you know, can God make a rock so big that he can't even pick it up? Either answer says that God is not omnipotent, right? And when you ask someone, and again, I have no idea what Andrew Tate's real personality is, but his public persona is the one, it's pretty consistent. And his public persona is such that if you ask him that question, have you ever had a belief that you found to be wrong and you changed it, then that's in a similar vein, not exactly the same as that God with the rock thing. Because if he, you know, on one hand, it's like, well, yeah, I have full control over myself, so I'm going to change my beliefs. You know, I'm that strong. But on the other side, at some point, he had to have been wrong. So there's no way out of that question. There's no answer to that question that will have his public persona upheld in which he's perfect and he's never been wrong. So he, at the very least, you know, possibly subconsciously, but maybe consciously, just interprets the question in this different way of like, well, yeah, people, you know, and also for people with this public persona, or I'll just say with this presentation, either publicly or privately, they are very outwardly focused. They're very, very focused on how other people see them. It's really an obsession because they're in this constant state of trying to prove themselves because of what they went through when they were growing up.
I will never adopt the thinking of somebody who is sad, and I will never adopt the thinking of somebody who is less competitive than I am or less successful than I am. If someone comes along and goes, Andrew, you are wrong, the way you see the world is wrong, but they are suffering from an affliction, mm-hmm. Why would I adopt a single one?
And it's also possible, it's hard for me not to see this through my therapist lens. If I asked that question to an individual who was presenting this way, and they answered this way, I would wonder if they're actually saying something to me, which often will be the case. Clients like this, especially if they're volunteering for therapy, they don't want to get into a fight with me. That's not what they came to therapy for. So when they have what they perceive to be an attack, and people like this can absolutely perceive it as an attack, that question that David asked, which is, you know, did you ever have a belief that you had to change? It can be very threatening because they kind of know what that's implying. And they also suspect that it's a question that reveals a bigger idea in the therapist's mind that is skepticism of the client's presentation and way of thinking. And so it's very threatening to them. And so some of them will respond in the way that Andrew Tate did by saying, well, yeah, people are always trying to tell me that I'm wrong. But what the client is really saying is, you're telling me that I'm wrong, which isn't what David was saying. But because of the traumas and the schemas and the lens and the reactivity, that's how it's felt. And then the client will triangulate, talk about outside people, but they're really talking to the therapist.
Bio of what they say. So it's kind of funny when I talk about depression, the number of people who defend depression, mm-hmm. depression's ruined my life, it's super real, and I lost my wife, and my life is over, and I want to kill myself, it's real. I'm like, surely you should like my worldview. If depression's so terrible and it's destroyed your entire existence,
right,
you should be listening.
I'm sure this is a straw man that he is constructing, the way he mockingly role plays people that are saying that depression is real. And then his response is just so, well, it's deplorable too. What it sounds like is someone reached out to him and said, well, I'm really depressed, and your notion that somehow that you can just overcome depression by sheer willpower is not working for me, or is hurting my feelings, because it, basically you're saying I'm weak or something. And so they're seemingly trying to convince Andrew to, no, depression is real. Believe me, I've been through some really bad experiences, and now I have a hard time getting up in the morning, and I feel no motivation, and I don't take pleasure in anything anymore. And I need medication that kind of helps sometimes, and I go to therapy and it kind of helps sometimes. And but then another bad thing will happen to me, and I, you know, I can't sleep at night, or I sleep too much, or I'm gaining weight, or I can't eat, or, you know, it's a real thing. Obviously, I don't have to tell you that. But for Andrew Tate to, you know, create this straw man of someone that's just like stubbornly weak or something, and then he says, well, surely, wouldn't you want my perspective? Because my way is better. Just don't be depressed. Yeah.
To me, tell you it's not real. Right. But instead, they're defending it and sticking up for it, which I find very interesting. So that's the first thing. In regards to whether I have had any of my convictions challenged, it's kind of amazing. Maybe it's just a semantics trick, and maybe it's that simple. Maybe it's as simple as saying, I feel a little bit depressed today, but I am not a depressed person, right, and I cannot become depressive. I'm not good.
So actually, what he's talking about is a well-known and established technique in treating people with various different issues, including depression. You can call it cognitive therapy. You can call it narrative therapy. That exact phrase will be used in therapy. I've used it sometimes, or proposed it. You know, they will say, I experience depression, but I am not a depressed person. And what they mean by that is, I'm not going to let this become my identity, because if I let it become my identity, then I've truly given up, or I'm truly lost, or everything will be filtered through that identity. I'm experiencing depression every day for the past 3 months, but I refuse to believe that I am a depressed person. Or it can be medical too. Someone can say, I experience chronic pain, but I refuse to be a chronic pain person. I'm not going to be labeled as that. I'm not going to think of myself as that. I experience chronic pain, and it's awful. Another tangent to this is to externalize. Various different therapies use this technique of saying, I am me, and the depression is over here. It's happening at me. And I might even give it a name, like Mr. Poopy Pants, or the demon. You know, I'm just thinking of names that clients have used, or the dark sphere or something. And it helps to say that, because for some people, when they're depressed, they start to think of it as being a part of who they are. It becomes infused in their personality. And when, for some, not everyone, but when they do that, then it can be very hard to dislodge it. Even when, you know, for some people, when they actually start to recover from depression, you know, say that they've been depressed for 5 years, 15 years, and they actually go to therapy, they go on medication, they start to emerge. They might, for example, they get invited to something, and as soon as they get the invitation, they're like, I don't go to that. Because they still identify as a depressed person, even though if they thought about it, they actually want to go to the thing they're being invited to, but they're operating from the identity of a depressed person. I suspect for Andrew Tate, if he truly has never been depressed, that there have been times when he has felt demoralized and pessimistic and worried about the future, or maybe even wanting to give up, wanting to say, I just can't try anymore. I don't want to fight anymore. I just want to sit here. And then he finds that if he, you know, says, no, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to continue to fight. For him, he's saying that's depression. That's not, you know, I don't know, but if that is the case, that's not depression. That's just demoralization. That's lack of will, burnout, that kind of thing. And you know, I think that that would be fine if that's what, now, you know, the asterisk to all this is that if the allegations are even somewhat on the mark, then it sounds funny to say that it's okay. I'll just say it's okay for an individual, independent of the situation that they're in, to engage in that way of thinking if they're trying to get out of demoralization.
Have depression. Maybe it's just a semantics trip. And by saying that alone, I understand that it's a temporary state of mind, which I can alter and I can affect. And I've never struggled with long-term depression or long-term negative thoughts because I don't believe in that mental model.
So I've never struggled from long-term depression. I've never suffered from short-term depression because I was raised very well. And biologically, I'm not prone to that. People in my family aren't prone to that. We're prone to anxiety. I've never had I've never even been close to being clinically depressed. But it's not because I have this magical willpower of some sort. It's genetics, it's upbringing, it's attachment. So he's attributing it to his willpower or strength or something. And I think he's, one, at the very least, trying to sell his product. Because if he says this, then he can get people to pay for things and he can make more money. But I also wonder if he needs to believe this because he needs to feel like he is superior and special.
Believe in that. I don't think it's possible, so it just doesn't happen.
You said you experienced some form of depression or depressive feelings and sadness in prison. What were the thoughts that were coming up?
So this is a question that I might ask too in this situation. Everything depends on what Andrew Tate, if he were to talk with me or someone like him, what they wanted from me. You know, you might wonder, well, why would someone like Andrew Tate even come to therapy? Well, I'll tell you from memory and also just from research that people who present like Andrew Tate, they might come across like they have everything figured out, and they might consciously believe that they have everything figured out, but the underlying traumas and their defenses and the way they treat other people result often in them having a very hard time getting their needs met, specifically their needs met regarding dependency, interdependency, mutual dependency and love and attachment and neediness. They deny their neediness very firmly and are very upset if you even imply that they have needs around this, that they have normal human emotions and attachment needs. And so they will go their whole life without getting those needs met, and they will become symptomatic in some way. They might become depressed. They might use a lot of substances. They might feel empty on the inside. They might feel like their life is meaningless. They might notice that they're getting into a lot of fights with their spouse, or that they find they are quick to rage in ways that they can't control. And so they might get fired from a job, they might go through a divorce, and suddenly, even though they know they have everything figured out, they also suspect that something's going on, so they end up in therapy. Another presentation is that they kind of know that something's going on with them, but they don't really know what it is, and they can't really admit that there's anything wrong with them, but they do want to explore things. They have enough flexibility within their personality to say, I would like to explore my childhood or the way that I think or philosophies that I should be adhering to. And they might even seek out a therapist that they perceive as having a lot of intelligence. For a lot of people like this, it's incredibly important that they find someone that they believe to be at their level intellectually wise. And so they might seek out a therapist. And you know, when they come to my office, the beginning of therapy can feel very without foundation because I don't know. I keep asking them like what they want and they keep saying exploration. And I'm like, okay, what do you want to explore? And then they might explore certain things. But at the end of every session, it feels like because there are people that want to explore things. But the real issue is with these folks is they're not actually wanting to explore things. They keep running into a barrier. They have some part of their motivation and their personality that's saying, I need help. But another part of them is saying, no, no, no. So they do this limbo zone in therapy where they're kind of exploring, but not really. And so once I detect that, then I do a lot of various things based on what's being presented, and I'll test the waters. I'm trying to connect with this part of them. And I'm trying to soothe this part of them. I'm like, hey, it's, you know, you don't need that. It's okay. The barrier's fine. You know, and, but you know, this part is a good part. Let's, you know, let's let it over the barrier sometimes. That's the visual, I guess, I have in my mind right now. But, and there's other presentations too, but at any rate, he is now asking, David's now asking, so you identify in prison that you were sad, depressed, something was happening. What was going on there? So this will be very interesting to see how Andrew Tate responds, because if he has it in him and he also trusts David and he is willing to share with the entire world on the internet, then he might say something like, well, yeah, it was a pretty dark moment for me, but I, you know, but then, but at the very least, he would admit that he does have human emotion. But there's another possibility that if this, because if I were in David's shoes, I wouldn't ask this question at this point because I would worry that I would step on a landmine. And the risk here is that Andrew Tate could, well, one, just walk out. That'll happen sometimes. But the other is that he'll say, well, you know, I said depression, but, you know, everything, you know, it's astonishing how denial works for people. And when you're really concentrating on a client and you see them within the same sentence or paragraph completely contradict themselves, you see that transition from, you know, saying something to denying it. And I, you know, I don't judge it. I do it too. We all do it. There's a reason for that. But there's a possibility that he'll just go into complete denial. Although he's already led the way. So let's see what Andrew Tate does here.
What was happening?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty, which is the first thing which
that has to be scary.
It is scary.
And then David very adeptly identifies with the emotion for therapists and really for parents, for teachers, just friends. This is a very good thing to keep in mind that when people first present, you know, I'll be talking to other therapists who obviously have a lot of emotional intelligence, and even those folks will frame things intellectually. They will intellectualize as a defense. So what happened was fear, was the terrifying feeling that Andrew Tate was going through because of the uncertainty. The uncertainty was happening of, will I be in prison forever? Will everything fall apart for me? Will I have no more fans? You know, it's terrifying. You could say it's justified that he has that terror, but whatever. He has that terrifying feeling, but he intellectualizes that as he recalls it and says, there was a lot of uncertainty. The therapist, again, friend, listener, parent, teacher, it can help if you think that it's safe enough to do this to say, wow, that must have been terrifying. And the fact that Andrew Tate responded, well, one, the fact that Andrew Tate even presented something that David could respond means that Andrew Tate is flexible enough, healthy enough, if you will, and trusts David enough to say such a thing. And maybe he learned something in prison that he needed to talk about this more. So I don't know. Who knows? But he says uncertainty. David says, that must have been terrifying. And he says it in an empathetic way. And then Andrew Tate says, yes, it was terrifying. That's when you know therapy is working or a conversation is working. When, as David intuits very quickly, and might have even been kind of setting it up or trying to get to this place, I wouldn't be surprised if David didn't have a plan, but was acting intuitively, but had kind of a general direction that he wanted to go. That's typical, because it's the thing that happens with novice therapists. They tend to make a lot of plans because they're really nervous about providing therapy. And so, you know, the night before they'll be like taking, okay, I want to do this. I want to get here. I want to get here. 99.99% of the time, those plans are completely thrown out the window because you cannot predict what'll happen in a session, even with clients that are fairly predictable. Anyway, so David, you know, asked that question, and then Andrew's like, the quickness, right? You're past someone's defenses. And the fact that Andrew Tate, you know, eye contact, that's another kind of thing to watch, is that when does Andrew Tate look at his eyes as opposed to not? For people who present like this, and I don't know Andrew Tate's personality, but people who present like this typically have a background, an upbringing in which they were harmed and or neglected fairly significantly. And early in life, at the age of 12 months old, they learned it was better not to have eye contact, because to have eye contact meant that you were going to get hurt or rejected. And so it's just better to turn away and to not be noticed or to just focus on something else. And so when they're exploring and having a conversation, they will tend to do this. If you ever notice, you know, it's not something that's always the case. You know, eye contact is kind of complicated. Some people just need to think, and so they will not look at your face because it's easier for them to concentrate if they're sort of just looking into the void. But and there's a lot of pseudoscience around eye movements. It's all nonsense. Science has debunked it 1,000 times over. But eye contact is something that will show patterns and does have indications of something potentially. Anyway, but he locks in on David. Like, let's rewatch that.
Depressive feelings and sadness in prison. What were the thoughts that were coming up? What was happening?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty, which is the first thing which
that has to be scary.
It is scary. It's scary.
And also,
so if I had a supervisee, a trainee in my university or someone I was supervising who showed me a clip like this, I would really highlight how well they nailed that. They set up the question, not manipulatively, but they intuited to ask, you know, like, what was it like there? And also the delivery that David has, he is natural. He doesn't come across like he's trying to get him, right? It comes across like he's a human being, like he's asking from his own heart, not from his head. So he's asking that question. Andrew Tate responds. And then immediately David says, it must have been in the natural way that he responds. Oh, that must have been terrifying. I could role play a robotic version of that. Like, that must have been terrifying. I don't know. So with my trainees and myself, when I was first becoming a therapist, you're often terrified of what it is to be a therapist. And so you just want a prescription. It's like, tell me what to do. And you end up absorbing these listening techniques, and then you try to follow those rules. But when you're thinking about them too much, they don't come from your soul, from your heart, from your humanness, and other people will be put off by that, obviously. So you have to get so used to those techniques such that they just naturally fly out of you, emerging from your humanness, which it did seemingly for David. And I think Andrew Tate responded to that in that way.
He was totally in control of your world, of your life. And that's almost like an imperative for you.
Correct.
And that gives you power. And all of a sudden you're thrust into a situation where you're essentially helpless.
Well, you just nailed it. You completely nailed it, because I was exactly about to say, it's the uncertainty that I struggle with the most, because in my life, I'm in charge of everything. I know exactly how everything works, and I'm the boss, and I get to control absolutely everything. And this is the first time in a long time I'm in a scenario where I have no power whatsoever,
yeah.
No influence, basically.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what's going to happen. Nobody else knows what's going to happen.
So that's interesting, and I'm guessing that David is picking up on this, that Andrew Tate is, I don't know if he knows he's revealing this, but he's essentially revealing that he has a complex or a need for the defense that involves him constantly being in control and or believing that he's in control. None of us are in control of wide swaths of our lives. For people that go through sudden medical changes will attest to that. You know, we tend to walk around thinking, well, as long as I eat right and exercise right and take care of my body, everything will be fine. And then all of a sudden, boom, something happens regardless of you taking care of yourself. And then you realize, oh, I guess I don't have full control over my lives. And so that notion that he believes that he's in constant control of everything is absurd. And we all benefit from recognizing that we don't have full control over things. And existentially, we really have to accept it. We have to fully embrace the reality that we don't have control over some very fundamental things. Like life itself, we all die. We don't have control over that. We don't have control over time and aging and the economy and our spouses, let alone our own behavior and psychologies. So the notion that he's in constant control of everything in his life all the time, you know, it just illuminates some need. I'm contrasting that with, you know, the fact that he says he's in constant control is in such contrast with reality. It points to that he needs to believe and will do a lot of things to give him evidence that he's in control. And of course, that points potentially to trauma, that he was traumatized. You know, when people go through trauma early or really throughout one's life, but particularly when it's chronic over time as a child, whether you consciously identify with this or not, you will feel very much like you have no control over things, particularly if the chaos and the abuse and the mistreatment had to do with things like your parents moving from town to town or your parents with substance abuse can also cause children, even though the child isn't being abused directly, they feel very much out of control, like they wish they had control. And then once they get older and they have more power over their lives, one road of defensive structure is to be obsessive about control such that you will not have to risk going back to the way things were when you were young. The irony is that when individuals do this, they tend to, in a way, recreate what happened when they were young inadvertently. Because when you're a 2-year-old child, 5-year-old child, what you're wanting is security and love and attunement and safety and certainty, or at least a lack of undue uncertainty. And so when you are denied that and there's chaos and abuse and mistreatment, and you're like, okay, if I only had control, then I would be able to get that attunement and love and safety. And then they just focus on the control. Then they grow up and they say, okay, I'm doing the control thing. And they will push out all relationships and any flexibility, because in order to be in a relationship, you have to accept that you don't have control over much. You know, with my wife, I have zero control over her and her personality. I don't even have control over myself, for crying out loud. How could I possibly have control over her? And accepting that and working within that reality and having humility around that and allowing other people to run the show when they want to or when they need to is a part of a relationship, and that's how things go. And so when someone dedicates themselves obsessively to control, you could imagine that they would deny themselves any kind of relationship. So they're actually recreating the past and that they're very alone.
In my world, I'm the hero, right? I'm the head of the clan. Not just my family, right, but of a lot of people. A lot of people rely on me. Lots of women rely on me. Children rely on me, etc. So everyone comes to me every time there's a problem. So they continue to do that while I'm in a jail cell, expecting me to have some kind of answer.
Right.
And I'm like, well, I don't have an answer this time. Every other time I had an answer, but this time is a bit unique.
How did that feel? You don't have the answers.
So yeah, it's good. Good therapist, good instinct. And it takes a skilled therapist to let a lot of those things go by, the things that Andrew Tate says. You know, I'm not in my therapist mode right now. I'm YouTuber mode, I suppose. So when I'm listening to Andrew Tate talk, you know, there are just a couple lines. And, you know, if he just said there was uncertainty, I didn't know what was going on, and I was letting a lot of people down, then it wouldn't irk me. But the way he frames it is, I had all these women that depend on me and all these children that depend on me, and people are coming to me for answers. And I said, hey, circumstances are different now. You know, it's a weird way to frame all that. It's an indication of the way he sees the world. There's always an opposition. There's always someone outside of him that is being annoying, right? And so to look past all of that, just let that go past you as a therapist, and to try to highlight the content that Andrew Tate is presenting that is more human and might head down a road of perhaps helpfulness to Andrew Tate. I think that's what David is trying to do. Let's rewind that.
Time I had an answer, but this time is a bit unique.
How did that feel? You don't have the answers. You can't help.
Yeah. I mean, it was frustrating. It's very frustrating, and it's the uncertainty that would bother me. I don't think I felt sad very often, but I certainly felt extremely frustrated. Mm. I would sit there and think, there has to be a way out of this room.
This is interesting. He is being more vulnerable than I've ever seen. And I've probably seen 0.01% of the content that he has, probably even less than that, on the internet. I've barely watched any of his material. So maybe he's like this often, but the stuff that I've seen, he does not even come close to this kind of humanness, right? Now, it's not as human as I would wish for him so that he would live a happier life. And I don't know, but I suspect a happier life that would not harm other people. I don't know if he's harming others, but there's a lot of evidence that he might be. So he has a long way to go to get there, but you know, this is in that direction.
I wake up and I go, I want more money. If I can get pissed off enough about it, I can do 36-hour workdays, right? So there's nothing wrong with being angry in my world as long as you are putting it in the correct direction. It's uncontrolled anger, I think, is a problem.
Right. Anger can be used as a fuel, and it's necessary. And from my framework, anger sometimes is a mask for pain.
I'd agree with that.
So I just figured out where David Sutcliffe, I know him from. He is Chris on Gilmore Girls. He's Rory's dad. The beard just makes him look so different. But if I just don't look at the beard, everything above the beard, that's Chris from Gilmore Girls. So it's just weird. I've watched Gilmore Girls 3 times, I believe, all the way through. At first, I didn't like it because I thought they talked too fast. And I also thought that Lorelai's parenting was problematic, but over time, I fell in love with the show. And I wonder if it's time to watch again. Although, there's so many shows I want to watch again, like The Office and Parks and Rec. What was I saying? He is saying that... Let's rewind.
Anger can be used as a fuel, and it's necessary. And, from my framework, anger sometimes is a mask for pain.
Right, so he's either using emotion focus therapy or some other framework of therapy or his own, as he puts it, that will put forth that anger can often be a secondary emotion or a response to being hurt or being afraid. And that is something that I find to be a very useful framework. Sometimes it's hard to fit every experience of anger into this framework, but often it is useful to see this way, and it does resonate with people, and it resonates with me. And I think what David is trying to get at is you were angry that you were incarcerated because you were no longer in control, and you're saying that you were frustrated and you were angry. Is it possible that there was some other emotion that preceded that anger, like being hurt or being afraid? Can you admit that to yourself? And I hope that people understand that therapy is not about digging up emotions or making people vulnerable just to make people vulnerable. It's designed to help people. It depends on the context, depends on the way it's done. Generally speaking, when you see this kind of interaction, the therapist is doing this kind of against the... It's sort of like a therapist. So if I was in David's shoes and I was treating someone like Andrew Tate, I would kind of see Andrew Tate as two different people or two different modes within him. One is the true Andrew, someone who is human and able to have all the normal human emotions and wants to have those emotions and wants to express them, wants to have them received, wants to have them taken care of, also wants some self-compassion around those emotions. I would see that. Then I would see another part of Andrew, of him being defensive about it, saying, and everyone has these modes. Even very emotionally intelligent people will, when they narrativize their life, they will have a much easier time identifying frustration and anger and irritability than they will expressing or even acknowledging to themselves that they were afraid or they were hurt. So what I'd be thinking if I were in David's shoes is, okay, I'm getting the defense, but how do I get to the real Andrew Tate? And so when I get there and that part of him is allowed to express himself when he feels safe, then I will reward that, so to speak, with a corrective experience of making him feel heard and understood and not judged and safe and cared about. And then the defensive part of him that is always saying, no, I'm just angry or I don't have emotions, that defense won't be needed as much. And the ego won't utilize it as much so that the real human on the inside is able, you know, we have needs around that. When we have an emotion, it's an indication typically of a need that is being perturbed or satisfied, you know, because emotions can be joy and other kinds of positive emotions. So when we are hurt and we are afraid, we have, something's happening to us, and it's very common that we want to express them to ourselves, to have it be acknowledged, and also have it be reacted to. I'm fairly certain, and there's no way to prove this or to experiment on humans in this way to find out, but there's a lot of evidence pointing to the very strong possibility that we evolved emotions like sadness because it benefited us. It benefited us in terms of procreation and survivability, in that when, for example, when we are left alone, you know, imagine 200,000 years ago and we're with our 50 members of our extended family and tribe, and we are traveling around looking for food or shelter or something, and we're 5 years old or 50 years old, and we wander off and we get left behind. And then we get hurt. We're hurt because we thought that people cared about us. We also get afraid because we might be attacked. You know, there were predators like the sort of cat kingdom, the feline kingdom would regularly eat us as humans. We weren't at the top of the food chain back then. And so we evolved to have that immediate feeling of fear and also of hurt, of like, hey, I thought people cared enough about me to tell me that they were leaving or to watch over me. And then one, you're afraid. So you start looking around and you're oh my God. And so you are motivated to solve that fear by running and finding your people. Let's say you do, but then that fear of hurt, of your feelings hurt, also kicks in so that it motivates you to cry or to say something of like, hey, you guys hurt my feelings. And then that alerts other people like, oh, next time, let's make sure that we tell Kirk that we're leaving and we don't leave him behind because I have compassion. It's that whole emotion, behavior, perception matrix, if you will. And then that led to that Kirk 200,000 years ago living longer to be able to procreate and to propagate one's genes. So we have these needs, and when those needs are being frustrated, like we're being told by society that we can't have sadness or fear, then we just stuff it and we don't do anything about our emotions. We have things that are happening to us that cause fear and cause hurt. And we're just like, well, I'm a bad person. I'm ashamed of it. No one wants to listen to me, so I'm just going to keep it down. I'm going to have a strong mind. I'm going to have willpower. I'm going to distract myself with alcohol or weed. And all the while, one's needs aren't being met. But we evolved to do that, and when we are able to do it, we can relax. And there's a function to it. Forget 200,000 years ago. If you look at today, when someone doesn't invite you to a party or even just more simple, you're at the mall and your friends just wander off and they don't tell you that they're wandering off, you get sad and you go, hey, I felt like you kind of ditched me. Oh, I'm sorry. It keeps us bonded. It keeps us in our relationships. It alerts people that you care about the relationship or something. There's a lot of function to that. And so when therapists are asking clients for this information of trying to soothe the defensive part of them, the defense, and create safety for the humanness to come out. It's not just digging for emotion because it's like, aha, I got Andrew Tate to be vulnerable. It's actually a function of trying to help someone to realize that they can be human and that they are human and that there are options. You know, the hope would be for someone like Andrew Tate is, the next time I have an emotion, maybe I'll actually acknowledge it and put aside my defensiveness and maybe even reach out to people in a way that is meeting my needs.
I'd agree with that.
So did you experience pain in there? I know that's pain is a kind of an abstract word, but was it painful?
So David asked another zinger, did you feel pain? And then Andrew Tate goes, which I would suspect if I were in David's shoes that this is going too vulnerable or we've gone for too long in vulnerability. And then David follows it up with another version of that, trying to soften it a little bit because I think he noticed that. Because previously when David would ask a question that was getting at the vulnerable feelings, Andrew Tate would go like, yeah. And that's when you know you're in the flow. But now Andrew Tate is going, then that usually indicates to us therapists that, I've threatened something. We were in the flow and now he's doing this. It's also possible that Andrew Tate just has to think about it, but let's see what he says.
Like, I want to know about your pain.
Yeah, it's strange because I'm being as honest as possible. It's strange because I had this instilled sense of duty where even though I'm in a jail cell and I can't leave, and even though I'm cripplingly bored, I don't feel like I had time to feel pain, or I didn't feel like I had time to be a victim.
You had nothing but time.
No, I didn't have time.
What are you talking about?
Because everyone outside still relied on me. So when I would get on the phone, people would say,
is that avoidance though?
I don't know.
Do you keep busy?
If David were my trainee or he hired me to consult about this session, I would ask David what was going on with him in this moment because he's kind of peppering Andrew, who cares, just a YouTube video, but if this was an actual therapy session, I would worry that David is actually losing Andrew at this point, because, you know, the pain question was met with him, Andrew, saying, I didn't have time to feel pain. And David's contention is, you must have been feeling pain, because it's just, I'm guessing David is thinking it would be impossible for you not to feel some version of pain. It might help if David were to specify what he means by pain, like self-disappointment or hurt from the attacks or something like that. But the way that Andrew is responding, it's a different mode than we saw earlier. It's also possible that the way that Andrew sees the word pain, he actually didn't feel pain. So it's also possible that Andrew's trying to appease by answering it kind of, instead of just saying, no, I didn't feel pain. Although, you know, it's possible that David has it all figured out and he knows, like, he needs this to happen in the conversation for it to go in the direction that he hopes it will go.
You avoid your feelings by keeping busy, being on the computer all the time?
All the things I had to do still had to be done. Just because they threw me in a cell, it just made it more difficult, which means I have less time than ever because the difficulty's been increased. And when I would get on the phone, we wouldn't discuss how I'm feeling. I'd be worried about how everyone else is. They'd be like, how are you? Yeah, I'm in jail. What's going on with this? Are you okay?
So it's very consistent with the persona that he presents, that self-denial of his humanness. And what that'll do to someone is the needs and emotions will pile up and pile up and pile up and express themselves in very problematic ways. If the allegations about Andrew Tate are even halfway true, I have very little sympathy for him as an individual. But I will say I've treated a lot of people who present like this, who did not commit crimes that he allegedly committed, that I had tremendous compassion for, because even though they present this way as very pompous and they brag a lot and they have it all figured out, that at their core, the thing that I tell people is that underneath the defensive structure of someone with narcissism is a borderline person. You know, if you're familiar, people with borderline personality disorder on the surface can be very vulnerable, and their emotions are they wear their heart on their sleeve. They announce their emotions. They have a lot of pain and fear and hurt, and they will let you know about it if you're close enough to them. And for people with a narcissistic defensive structure, underneath is all of that, but they just have a way of masking it to themselves and others. And almost you could see it as people with narcissism are worse off than people with borderline, because at least people with borderline express it sometimes, which will provoke at least sometimes attunement from other people or care or compassion, and maybe from themselves. At the very least, they'll look at themselves and their needs, and they'll be like, my needs aren't being met, or I have these emotions. For people with narcissism, that never happens, unless they have a complete meltdown, which does happen sometimes. I'm not diagnosing them, of course. I'm just talking about my clinical experience. It's possible his persona has nothing to do with his real personality. But I use this as a jumping off point for people to think about their own lives for themselves. Some of you might also be on the narcissistic spectrum and might benefit from realizing that you too also have a lot of pain and hurt on the inside. That, in fact, that is the primary corrective experience and awareness for people who are on the narcissistic spectrum. For these individuals, the primary therapeutic drive that I have is vulnerability, 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 and attunement when they are vulnerable, meaning they are vulnerable with someone who is attuned and cares. And to the point where with my clients who are on the narcissistic spectrum, at some point in every session, I or they will mention this. You know, I know that I'm sort of in a later phase of therapy with someone like this when they come into therapy and they say something like, oh, Kirk, you'd be so proud of me. So yesterday, I noticed some bad things were happening for me. So I sat down and thought about my vulnerable side, and I even indicated it over a text to my wife that she hurt my feelings. And I did that. I said that I was sad. I was hurt. You'd be so proud of me, you know, because for years I've been telling them, trying to convince them that the road to wellness for them is through their own vulnerability. By being vulnerable with people that they can trust, it'll solve their emotional problems and their relational problems. Because when you are vulnerable, it, you know, lets other people in, and it explains a lot of things. You know, if for, you know, a typical story would be someone on a narcissistic spectrum, they get triggered and they start to criticize and lecture their spouse. So say it's a husband, so he will start to criticize his wife and lecture her and say, you're so emotional and you're illogical and, you know, it's always about you, you know, just kind of those kinds of attacks. And then the next day, he, through therapy, has learned, okay, they start to have these bullet points that they've, you know, because it doesn't naturally occur to them. It barely naturally occurs to anybody, but particularly them. So they wake up the next morning and say, okay, I got in a fight last night, and I know through years of therapy that the road to wellness is vulnerability. And so what was happening, you know, I'm in my head, this obsession about how my wife is wrong. That's all that I can think of. That's all that's in my brain. But if I want to save my marriage and myself, I have to assume that I am not being vulnerable, I'm not expressing it, and that there's some sort of hurt and some sort of fear that's going on. What is that? And then he might say, oh, well, she triggered me earlier in the night because she was late from work or something, or she undermined me with parenting, or I wanted to go on this vacation with her and she said that she didn't really have interest in going to that location or something. And then that triggered me because I was hurt, but I didn't know I was hurt, so I went on the attack and da-da-da. Okay. Next morning, they're like, okay, that's what happened for me. And then they will tell their wife, and as, you know, there's baby steps, right? They're not completely vulnerable, but, you know, they test water. So, you know, he texts his wife, you know, I'm sorry about last night, and my feelings were hurt when you said you didn't want to go to that location for vacation or something. And from the wife's side of things, it's very easy to narrativize the whole thing of, great, just because I didn't want to go to Cancun with my husband, I got 3 hours of anger and lecture and criticism because he's a psychopath and a sociopath who has no empathy and no compassion. And the reason why I don't want to go to Cancun is because I was traumatized there before, you know, some real reason as to why she, you know, she said what she said. And so, you know, for the wife, there's this narrative of just like, I don't matter. He is so self-centered and just mean for no reason. That's the narrative because that's the way it looks, right? But to hear from him to say, I was triggered and I was hurt. And of course, what she deserves is to not be treated that way. But if she were to be treated that way, for him to sit down and say, I'm so sorry, I have these issues. I was harmed when I was a kid and I was completely wrong. I should never have criticized you. You know, every time that I've done that, it's a defense. It's all my fault. That's what she deserves. But, you know, say she gets a little bit of that and it will solve a lot of things because she's like, oh, okay, that's different. I was narrativizing it as he's a sociopath, but now what he's telling me is that he has vulnerability that I can kind of relate to. He solves it by being critical and lecturing me, which is terrible. Now, she might still decide to leave, by the way. I'm not saying you're supposed to stay in a situation like that, but it solves his need to express his emotion and have it be heard and rewarded, at least by me as a therapist, and will resolve the conflict much faster. So, you know, the road to wellness is vulnerability. And it's really true for all of us, but particularly for people on the narcissistic spectrum and the avoidant attachment spectrum. All right, well, let's adjourn there. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.